wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Contemplating the futility of existence as he spoons cat food into his mouth in the Cutaway Bunker this week is Stephen Gallagher, English screenwriter, according to his Wikipedia page. Having been a professional writer since the early 1980s, Self had borne Stephen's many credits, include 11th Hour, Crusoe, Lucky Man, and based on his novel, 1991 cult classic, Chimera. But you're listening to a Doctor Who podcast, so it's likely you best know Steve for Warrior's Gate and Terminus. Today, amongst many other projects, we at Cutaway are lucky enough to have Steve writing for us on Faustine, Princess of Tharol, and I'm somehow his editor. Steve, welcome to The Bunker.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's an honour, as we never stop saying at Cutaway. As this interview is conducted through the prism of Doctor Who, I think before we get into your sort of background and stuff, I think actually your first choice, let's kick off with your first of your 5 choices, which is David Whittaker's novelisation of the Daleks. I take it this is a story from your very early childhood.
Yeah, I actually have the copy of the Armada paperback for boys and girls in my hand as I'm speaking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I kind of ruined it because I cherished it so much that when the spine started to come apart, I repaired it with brown paper, which, of course, is a terrible no-no for a book collector. But it's there, it's complete, and as prep for this chat, I did. I admit I flicked through it. I didn't read it cover to cover. Although having said that, I read the first couple of chapters and Whittaker could write. I mean, you know, the guy is a good prose writer, solid.
Yeah, I mean, I had as I was saying in our email exchange, that novelization was part of my childhood as well because I didn't get to watch the episodes and I didn't, you know, and it was illustrated as well as yours illustrated.
It is, yeah, with line drawings and quite good ones as well.
Yeah, I had a reprint of the same. I had a reprint of the same novelization. So, yeah, it's absolutely cracking. I mean, when did it come out? Like, not long after TV?
Let me check the copyright date. I have it right here. I mean, one thing that did throw me was in the first introduction of the Daleks themselves, he refers to them being 3 feet tall.
That would be very different.
Yeah. Well, here we go. The Doctor Who series copyright British Broadcasting Corporation 1963, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. Text of book copyright David Whittaker and Terry Nation 1964. So it's pretty hard on the heels of the show.
Well, 64 was Beatlemania, Dalek Mania year, wasn't it? So were you more aware, being 10, I think, in 64, were you more aware of Dalek Mania?
I was both. I mean, it was a good time for a kid to be alive. I always kind of moan a little bit that I was just that little bit too young to be participating in the Summer of Love and the whole scene. But from, you know, being on the cusp of adolescence, it was great. And the Beatles, Doctor Who, all the ITC telefantasy, all the stuff that was going on at that time, is what I credit as my kind of major formative, certainly artistic influences. I always say, you know, I must have had a really happy childhood because I've spent my entire life trying to recreate it in one form or another.
Yeah, I always think of your generation as the look and learn generation because I had a stack of those when I was a kid, when we moved house in the early 80s, and I found a T-shirt full of Look and Learns and fell in love with the Trigen Empire. And then looking through it, it was adverts for Captain Scarlet. It was, you know, it was that mixture of text and amazing artwork, and a bit like The Eagle and things like that. That kind of era. Were you a look and learn reader?
I kind of felt look and learn was for the posh kids. I was a TV comic guy, and then when I went from TV comic to TV 21, I mean, wow, you know, it's like that bit in a movie where the sides of the screen roll back, and you suddenly realise that the thing was going to be in widescreen all along, and they'd been fooling you at the beginning with just a little black and white square.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the TV 21 comics, obviously, to Doctor Who fans, are best known for their sort of Dalek strips, which are just kind of bonkers, seen from the modern. Now the lore's all been a little slightly more sorted out. They're kind of a bonkers kind of version of Skaro.
Oh yeah, it was like the Wild West of canon in those days. You know, you could more or less do anything. And you know, the field was all the richer for it. And somehow, as a kid, you know, you had no problem separating them out. So the stuff of the comic strips could coexist with the stuff on TV, and you didn't argue about, well, it doesn't agree, or you know, you actually appreciated the fact that here was a different take on something that you loved, and it was like coming at it from a completely different angle and a different perspective. Yeah. And I think we've lost a lot of that because of the obsession with callbacks and canon and fan service and all of that. I've always maintained, you know, Doctor Who had its origins and draws its strength and superpower from the fact that it is the best kids show in the world. And the rest of us are all guests at a children's party. Mm-hmm. And it behooves you as an adult to behave properly when you're a guest at a children's party. Otherwise, you deserve to get thrown out.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. I've always held with the, much as I, you know, like individual Torchwood episodes and things like that, I've always been of the opinion, and that's something we've sort of that's made its way into Cutaway as well, that Doctor Who should be suitable for, should sort of be certificate 12 at the most. Mm. So it, having elements of the Doctor Who universe that kids can't access always seems somehow slightly wrong to me. But talking of like widescreen Technicolor, you also mentioned that you know, that your Dalek novelization also reminds you of, I mean, do you remember seeing the original black and white Dalek episode, The Dead Planet, and what followed?
Yeah, I came in kind of halfway through, and I noticed in the novelization that it kicks off with kind of the unearthly child is the way into the story, and then it kind of segues into the Dalek story, having skipped over everything in between. And then along comes the movie, which is a different iteration of the same story, different setup. I love that as well. You know, it was big screen, it was widescreen, it was color, it was Daleks. I didn't care that it didn't integrate with what I'd already seen. I'd come in, I think, halfway through The Dead Planet. So it was other kids in the playground who'd caught Dalek mania early. And I got infected by contact. You know, all the kids were walking around with like one arm pulled in and one arm stuck out, and one arm was the gun and the other arm was the sucker, and they were doing the voice as well. And I thought, what the hell's going on here? Wow. And almost as a kind of wish to join in, I had to pester my parents because we had an old TV that would only get ITV; it wouldn't get the BBC. and so I pestered my parents to let me go to Grandma's house, because she had a TV that would get the BBC. And that's where I saw my first Dalek adventure. And after that, my dad actually devised a way, because the switch was faulty on this old black and white TV. I do remember now, and this is something I haven't thought about in a long time, but he cut down a pencil so that he could prop it between the broken switch and the frame of the TV to force the switch over so that we could get the BBC. And that's how... And that's how I came to watch the rest of it. But the movie, yeah, I mean, the movie was another mind blower. And my mother took me to Manchester, where, as a part of the promotion for the film, Lewis's department store at the top of Market Street, on their top floor, they'd given it over to a Dalek exhibition. And you kind of wove through these corridors with stills from the movie and little model dioramas and stuff like that. And then you emerged at the end of it. You know, and imagine how mind-blowing this would have been for a 10-year-old. You emerged at the end of it into the Dalek control room, which you had to cross. It was the set from the movie that had been transplanted and reconstructed in the top floor of Lewis's. You had to cross it and you had to exit through the doorway at the far end with a live Dalek on either side, with an operator inside who, you know, as every kid went past, was lunging towards the kids and menacing them. And I remember, you know, my mother told me afterwards I had to be dragged out of there shouting at them, shouting defiance at the Daleks.
My God, it's such a strange thing, because now here we are 60 years later. Mm. And I've done the same thing. Mm. I'm slightly younger than you. I'm 50. And my own kids have done the same thing. All three of them, mm. you know, the teenagers now, the youngest is 7. All three of them have been terrified by the Daleks at Salford, mm. Media City.
Yeah.
Or in various other locations. Mm. It's, and they've all run around shouting, exterminate.
Yeah.
Like, just like you guys did, and just like I did. And it is this mad. I love it.
It's a great creation.
That's what makes you proud to be British.
Yeah, I think it's also that it is a beautiful piece of sculpture. You know, mm. in all the forms and all the variations, the basic form of the Dalek is still something that is gorgeous to look at. You know, you can imagine it on a plinth in Trafalgar Square. In some sort of dystopian future when the Daleks have actually won. Yeah. And you can imagine it, you know, on top of Nelson's Column, looking fabulous.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's sort of like a weird miracle of all these things coming together, Doctor Who in general and the Daleks.
Because none of it makes any practical sense. You know, if you were designing a war machine, it wouldn't look like a Dalek. It wouldn't have... you know, one impractical sucker and one impractical gun that, you know, you can easily dodge. And
even
I know...
You wouldn't design a children's toy that had three things that could be snapped off.
Yeah.
A house full of broken Daleks.
A house full of broken Rolikins.
Yeah, but it is strange, because I guess they just came from his general scenario he created, which was an electron, you know, they were powered by electricity from the floor. Mm. There were mutants in a tank. And they had to have a gun and a sucker for some reason.
Yeah, it could so easily have been like an armed goblin in a Dodgem car.
It could have been, yeah. But somehow they came up in the heat of like not very long, they came up with like an absolute design classic. Mm. But it's just, yeah, just amazing. So I think your second choice is also in your childhood, which is the Dalek World Annual of 1965.
Yeah,
a book I think I've seen. Is that the one with the map of Skaro with Davius and a place called Darren in it, or is that a different book?
No, you're putting me on the spot. I'm not aware of that.
No,
so I'm going to say probably not. It's got gorgeously painted color adventures in it. Two of those, some not quite so well drawn line drawn adventures, and some text. And there are no actual. I don't think there are any actual credits to the artists or the writers, although the frontispiece is signed Jennings.
Mm, there will be comic book experts who will know.
I have I should know who Jennings is, because I have seen his name in various contexts, and I cannot immediately bring his initials or his first name to mind. So I apologize to him and his legacy, but it is fabulous work. It's kind of that, you know, look and learn TV 21 standard of painted pages.
Yeah, I think you'll find it's Richard Jennings.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Who,
yeah.
1921 to 1997.
Wow, lovely. Thank you for that information.
That was live Google.
But it's that fabulous thing.
He did a lot of TV 21.
Yeah, yeah, you can tell. I mean, it's fabulous. It's and it extends the Dalek lore in that the Daleks are not necessarily... the villains in the piece, you know, sometimes they're the protagonists of the stories in here.
Yeah.
And you see them, you know, on rocky worlds, exploding worlds, flying around on platforms, flying around in the vacuum in platforms, on platforms, you know, fighting spaceships. Stuff that at that time, the TV show just couldn't aspire to. And even the movie, you know, couldn't go that far. So, the power of print and the power of art and words.
I know it took 40 years for the TV show just to catch up and have Daleks whizzing around.
It did, and kind of in its heyday, you know, its early heyday. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's had another heyday since. Mm-hmm. But in its early heyday, you know, the joke used to be, oh, the wobbly sets. You know, fans love the wobbly sets and the crude. They didn't love the wobbly sets. They loved the show in spite of the wobbly sets. You know, there was enough there to make you overlook just about anything.
Yeah, I also think when you look back, to me, it's actually the wobbly sets came in later.
Hmm.
During time when it was almost being defunded by the BBC to make it fail. we're going to privatise Doctor Who. Well, actually, we're just going to cancel it.
There was a phase in the life of the show where, I mean, in the very early days, 405 line black and white resolution was so poor that all you needed was, you know, like a German expressionist film, all you needed was a few lines of sketch and a few shadows and you could create magic. And now, of course, you know, you create magic in its full detail. And in between times, around the time you were talking about when the show was kind of edging towards cancellation, it was not quite one thing and not quite the other. The resolution was good enough to show up the paucity of what had gone into it. And the technology was not yet good enough to overcome all of that.
It's a bit like when you watch, say, there's a Patrick Troughton episode where they have armies of cardboard Daleks and they look fine. So you look closely or you watch them on Blu-ray for some reason. And people go, oh, it doesn't look very good on Blu-ray. I wonder why.
And the thing is, I mean, people go to the National Theatre to see War Horse and they perfectly easily accept the fact that, you know, there's a puppet horse manipulated by people in black velvet. You can see the people manipulating it. You can see the fact that it's a puppet. You can see the rods. And you buy it as a horse because it's appealing to your imagination and you enter into a pact. You know, old TV was exactly like that. You entered into a pact of imagination where, you know, you were shown some triggers to your imagination and you filled in the rest. Whereas now one of the problems can be that people just expect it all to be done for them. And like when She-Hulk came out and they did the trailers, and the trailers of course were all advanced stuff, so they weren't fully finished effects or anything like that, but people were moaning about, you know, the quality of the CGI. And my reaction to that was, think yourself bloody lucky, you're getting CGI, you know, you're getting the show, you're getting told a story, enter the story, don't carp about the technology.
CGI luxury.
Colour separation overlay, as it was once called.
Oh God, yeah.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at cutawayuniverse.
So before we get onto your sort of your future choices, I guess now we'll leave your Doctor Who infused childhood behind. And is it safe to say that, I mean, from knowing you, is it safe to say that you are a science fiction? Do you identify as a science fiction fan slash, I mean, you don't always write science fiction, but science fiction, I would say, is very important in your life. And there's a brilliant podcast elsewhere, I'll put a link to it, where you talk about Nigel Neal as being important to you. What's your sort of relationship coming out of childhood into science fiction and then becoming a writer? I guess that's a huge swathe of time. The science fiction first.
Yeah, I mean, the science fiction part was as I started to read. You know, I mean, it was, to me, science fiction is and always will be literature first. As a kid, I joined the local children's library, and I think one of the earliest books I got out was The Complete Short Stories of H.G. Wells. Loved it so much that I solicited and got my own copy, which is still on my shelf. And I suppose, you know, on the one hand, there was that. On the other hand, there was the Professor Challenger stories of Arthur Conan Doyle, where you had Conan Doyle, who was a general storyteller, but, you know, also was adept at science fiction and loved that element of the imagination. And I think out of the two of them, I've kind of gone more down the Conan Doyle path than the Wells path. Because Wells never really abandoned that that aspect of him. He got political, but he never, in his fiction. I'm going down the wrong track here because I'm thinking now of, you know, History of Mr. Polly and Kipps. And so he kind of did have other areas. But Conan Doyle just about anything of Conan Doyle's I can read, whereas I can't read just about anything of Wells's. I'm not so into his social stuff. I'm not so into his political stuff. But as regards science fiction, that was, you know, that was my my foundation reading. And I always look upon myself as a citizen of that country, even though, you know, I spend time and spend most of my time out of it now. I will occasionally do a piece of short science fiction if I have an idea that demands it. But in terms of novels, in terms of, you know, the pictures I do for TV, I've kind of moved away from it as time's gone by. So there are not many of the new authors of science fiction that I read. And it's very rare that I'll pick up one of the old ones as well. And that, I think, is just a life thing. You know, you... you go through your various phases and your interests move around. If they don't move around, then that I suppose that's kind of sad, really. I have had the weird experience recently of editing and putting together new editions of the stuff that I wrote at the very beginning of my career when I was 23 years old, and I was writing for local radio, and it was a science fiction serial called The Last Rose of Summer. And a bunch of us put it together at Piccadilly Radio, just up the road from where I was working at the time, because I was working at Granada TV in Manchester. And I managed to parlay that 6-part serial up into a novelization. And then during the next 2 years, I wrote 2 more serials for Piccadilly and parlayed those up into books as well. And they've been out of print for God knows how long. And I've kind of been relieved that they've been out of print, because who wants your earliest work to have a light shown on it?
Your juvenile
down the line. Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, thanks to the magic of Twitter, every now and again somebody mentions it, you know, and mentions it with fond nostalgia. And I realize that, you know, that there are kind of two versions of the work out there. There's the work that I remember, and there's the work that other people remember. And so I decided that after leaving it untouched for so long and avoiding doing anything with it for so long, I thought, you know, bugger it, I'll digitize it. And then it's done, you know, and then it's out there in some form. You know, it's all the rest of my backlist is kind of digitized and available in ebook or paperback form. So so let's just complete the picture. And it was a very weird experience to re-engage as my own editor. Of this young guy who was just setting out. And some of it, a lot of it made me wince. And some of it, I looked at it and I thought, I can see what other people saw in me that made them think that I was maybe worth betting on, you know, maybe worth giving an opportunity to, maybe worth giving a chance to. But God almighty, how I wished I could go back and and redo that. Because there you are, you know, the young imagination without much discipline, leaping around like a puppy. And then you look back and, you know, you see the puddles that the puppy left. And the...
Oh, what a lovely puppy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is it all the usual... Is it all the usual things, like you use 3 words and when one will do, and some sentences that get away from you? And
not so much that. I wasn't bad at the language. It was the ideas, you know, because your ideas, your original thoughts, are a kind of synthesis of your input and your own impressions. You know, I mean, there's no such thing as an original thought that comes out of absolutely nowhere. You know, you put these two things together. And I suppose at that point in my career, I wasn't very good at synthesizing them, and I wasn't very good at recognizing what was a good idea and what was one that had been, you know, maybe retrodden or didn't fit in with what I'd already done. You know, consistency is something that it took me a while to learn. You don't just throw in everything that you can possibly think of and leave it all kind of jostling up against each other in a weird smorgasbord. And I'm thinking now I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to knock another guy's work.
this is out. This will be out on the internet forever.
So yeah.
Be careful. I mean, another thing I was going to say was, a lot of people who are writers, it's in a way, it's quite a privilege that you get to say, oh my God, I was published and my work was out there that early.
Oh, yeah.
Most people, that work is in a drawer if it exists anywhere. Mm. It's in a drop. So you were a professional writer from an admirably young age, which is not to be sniffed upon. And that early stuff at Piccadilly Radio, which I didn't really know about, actually, but that makes more sense as to why you then became a very young Doctor Who writer. And I know there's a little bit of a... You had to make a leap, though, didn't you, from the sort of safe and secured employment to becoming a screenwriter. I mean, What was that era of your life like?
It was great.
Doctor Who was beckoning.
It was great. It was followed by a bit that was not so great. And then there was a bit that was great again. And then there was another bit that wasn't. You know, it's been...
Yeah, that's life.
Steve Laws and his wife Melanie came to stay with us a few weeks ago. And we were talking about, you know, the best times of our lives. You know, what was the best... Melanie asked me, what was the best time of your life? And I had to say, well, all of it, really. So because there have been... It's been great. And there have been low spots, but every low spot has been the precursor to one of the really, really good things. And if you took the low spots out, you'd be taking the good things out as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what happened in those early days was I was working at Granada. I'd worked very briefly for Yorkshire Television as a researcher. That was my first proper job. I'd managed to blag my way into that. And a guy called John Wilford, who was their local programs editor, kind of interviewed me and put me on to John Willis. It was the son of Lord Ted Willis, who had just, his stock was very high because he just put together a documentary called Johnny Go Home, which was about homeless children in London. And I worked for him as a researcher for a brief period. And then I'd been applying for jobs here, there and everywhere. And I got an interview at Granada to be a promotion scriptwriter. And I didn't get the gig, but the guy who interviewed me for that, who was Colin Callender, I think it was, who's now a mega producer, called over to David Black, who ran the presentation department, and said, come and take a look at this guy. And David Black offered me the job of assistant transmission controller. And I did that for 5 years. And what I'd really wanted to do was get into TV drama. And I realized that being an ATC wasn't going to get me into TV drama. It was just going to mean that, you know, I was handling the output of the station as it went to air. You know, the BBC called them presentation directors. Well, I was kind of a junior presentation director. And it was frustrating because I was handling everybody else's drama and doing none of my own. And a bunch of us, you know, we had four continuity announcers, the guys who did the bits in between the programs and say, you know, and change of viewing here on Granada as we go to all that kind of thing. These guys were all equity card carrying actors who were as frustrated as I was at not getting the hands on any drama. So by some weird alchemy, a bunch of us got together and, you know, they said to me, you write stuff, don't you? You know, write something, we'll do it. And there was Tony Hawkins, who was the commercials production producer at Piccadilly Radio, just up the road from us, who all of the actors knew because they did voiceover work for him. And within that little circle, there was Pete Baker, who was the breakfast DJ at Piccadilly Radio, but who was an absolute whiz with the technology. And the bunch of us got together, and that's how we made that first radio serial. And that was the key to everything else, really, because as a result of doing that, you know, you have to write 6 half-hour episodes to tell a story. And telling the story over that distance, using scenes, using characters, using dialogue, was a really, really good grounding for just about any kind of fiction writing, because it was about the length and development of a novel story. It had a range of characters like a novel would, or a play would, or a movie screenplay would. You know, it had elements that served all of the different media. And on the back of that, I started writing and submitting to BBC Radio 4. They did a slot called Saturday Night Theatre, which was a 90-minute drama slot. And it was the popular drama slot where you could do mysteries, thrillers, comedies. You know, it wasn't elevated, but it was classy. And I came up with an idea called the Humane Solution. And I always remember the moment I came up with it, because my wife and I were going out one afternoon to, I think we were going out to shop, something like that. And as we were going out the door, I just said, can we just hang on a minute? And I ran back inside and I got a notebook, and it took me about 20 minutes and I wrote the entire plot of the Humane Solution. And it just kind of came in a flow. Like, I wish that still happened. But and I wrote it. You know, I put that to one side. We went out, and then based on that outline, I wrote it. Changed nothing. Wrote it exactly as I'd outlined it, and submitted it completely, you know, cold to the BBC. And I got an interview with Bernard Krzyzewski, who was the editor of Saturday Night Theatre at the time, and they bought the play. It was a play about a journalist stranded at Schiphol Airport in the fog, who realised that there was a terrorist attack going on. There was a hijacking out on the tarmac that that everybody in the airport was trying to keep from all the passengers who were waiting there. And it was a fabulous experience, because I sold the play. there were no great rewrites on it. And I was given, it was given to John Tideman, who was their senior drama director, a guy who'd, who he was subsequently to become head of drama at
BBC huge Radio. Names.
Yeah, yeah. And
casually dropping here.
Yeah, and I got Patrick Mower for my my leading man. And Patrick was riding really high at the time. He had that cop show that he had, the name of which is escaping me. But no, it was great. You know, because you could and still can get really, really good people for audio, because it's a chance to perform, it's a chance to do something that isn't dragged out, and it's not a great amount of their time. So you can get them for not much money.
Don't have to learn lines.
Yeah. And that again was, you know, my second launch pad, because I started selling radio dramas right, left and center. And in the meantime, I was flogging the novels. And come 1980, August 1980, I was 25 and I went freelance. And I cannot imagine now how my parents must have felt. For me to leap into the void off this rather good job. That everybody that I work with says, "Oh man, you've got a job for life here. Why are you leaving it?" Of course, it wasn't a job for life, because later it became computerized and now it's all centralized down in London. So if I'd left it any later, then I would have been sort of stuck for what to do.
25 and shortly. I mean, what a decision! But amazing.
It was an easy decision. That's the thing. You know, I look back and I think, God Almighty, how did I do that? You know,
yeah.
And of course, what then happened was, you know, I had my first book with Chimera, and that went really well. And my second book completely tanked, a book called Follower. I think it sold 7,500 copies. Mm. So, you know, after that great high, there was the first low.
Welcome to reality. But yeah. Not long after that, how did Doctor Who come about then? Your first one was Warrior's Gate.
Which that was quite kind of in the middle of all this. Yeah.
Is it plural Warriors with...
Warriors apostrophe gate, yeah. So yes. It's many, many warriors and their gate.
Yes, that's how I always write it. I think I've, you see it in so many different forms. Yeah. So many warriors gate. So how did that come about? Because obviously that's how, you know, you come to be working with us on Cutaway, because the Thowls that you created then, you've written the Thowls again with Faustine, Princess of Thowl, and I can't wait to start writing Thowls myself, spinning off from that brilliant two-part comic book that is shortly coming out, which we'll talk about a bit in the future. How did Warrior's Gate come about then? Sort of, it's got some mad ideas in it.
Brilliantly mad. Well, in that Radio 4 period, one of the pieces that I did was a science fiction play called An Alternative to Suicide. And I got one of their top guys directing, Martin Jenkins, and Michael Jaston for my lead. I met him last year at the thing we were at. Yeah,
for the listeners, we should say we were in Gallifrey One in LA back in February 2022.
Was this year, wasn't it? 2022, yeah.
COVID has messed everything up. Yes, this year, 2022. Yeah, we were in Gallifrey One, and one of the guests was Michael Jaston. Yeah, I remember you having a... Was that the first time you'd seen him since the recording?
It was, yeah, yeah.
How and, strange.
Well, he was lovely to me then, and he was lovely to me now. So.
Yeah, yeah. No, he seems a lovely man.
Yeah. But what happened there was that Martin Jenkins sent the script over to the Doctor Who office, unbeknownst to me. And again, you know, just like with how I got the Granada job, it was somebody saying, take a look at this guy. You know, you might be able to do something with him. And I got a call from Christopher Bidmead and said, come in, chat. And as a result of the chat, you know, I pitched some ideas, and one of them was just a single sheet of paper with the whole kind of layout of Warrior's Gate on it. And everything that was ultimately in Warrior's Gate was on that piece of paper, you know. And I'm a great sort of fan of minimalism, in that, you know, if you've got, I always compare it to a juggler, you know, if you've got a juggler who's not very good, but they have loads of different coloured bats and balls and stuff like that, they can always be pulling something new out to replace the thing they've just dropped. But the one who keeps you entranced is the one who just has the, you know, the three balls or the three clubs or whatever, and can do wonders with them, you know, continuous variations. So again, you know, it's not about how much you throw in, it's what you do with them. And I suppose with Warrior's Gate, I was throwing a lot in there. But really, the, you know, I mean, I talked before about you know, the synthesis of your inputs and your impressions. And the inputs on Warrior's Gate were things that I was absolutely entranced by at the time. And I've talked about this elsewhere, so I'm not saying anything new here, but one of them was Jean Cocteau's La Belle et la Bête, which I absolutely adored and still do. And the other was Grigory Kosintsev's Russian widescreen black and white version of Hamlet, which in which Hamlet's ghost is this tall, striding figure in black armor whose face you never see and whose voice comes, you know, as if from the bottom of the pit of hell. And in there you've got your Tharals, and in there you've got your Gundarns, and those are the two kind of poles around which I wove the whole thing.
Which is coming very useful for Cutaway in that design can draw that our artist Martin Geraghty, who whose artwork is absolutely wonderful.
Oh my God, isn't it just? Yeah.
But yeah, but that's been very useful in that, you know, he's been able to draw from your original sources rather than worrying about BBC copyright and things. He's sort of reimagining of the Tharals is absolutely wonderful. So yeah, so what was the reality of once you delivered your script, what was the reality of were you on set and all that kind of exciting stuff?
I was at the read through and I was on set for a couple of days, but the writer is not kind of the writer is not kind of regarded as part of the process once the script has been delivered in the UK. You know, where when I've worked in America, then you sit by the director's side while they're shooting, and if they want to change anything, they have to turn to you and discuss it and get your okay. You know, before they start shooting, they have a tone meeting where the writer lays out for the director exactly what it is they want to see in the show and how they want to see it. Completely different over here, where you kind of hand the script over. And they slam the door, leave you on the doorstep, and go inside and have the party. So the Writers Guild has negotiated a thing where I think, you know, the production company is obliged to pay a writer's expenses for a day or two on set. But in terms of being there, I always compare it to being one of the bride's old boyfriends at a wedding, you know, where they felt they had to invite you, but they'd rather you hadn't turned up.
Even in theatre, where the writer's really regarded, but once the text is fixed, you can sometimes see the writer walk through the door. As the writer, I walk through the door, and you can see the actors go, "Oh, hi!
Yeah.
We were looking forward to a really good rehearsal without you breathing down our necks." But
yeah.
Hi! Lovely script. We were just about to marmalise.
I remember Peter Davison saying, "Oi, oi, writers in the room."
Yeah, watch what you say.
Yeah, no. I mean, Peter was great. I mean, Tom was great in his way as well, but Tom was a firework.
He was at a certain point in his career as Doctor Who then as well, wasn't he? So
yeah,
I think probably said himself he wasn't. Maybe he should have left earlier. And then sometimes he says maybe you should never have left.
I think a lot of the Doctor Who actors go through maybe not so much now, but a kind of process whereby they look at themselves and they think, hang on, you know, I set out to do Shakespeare. I set out to be a big star. And here I'm doing this kids show. I could really do with moving on. You know, I could get out of this. And then years and years later, they look back and think, God, I was so lucky. And I think I think Tom himself has said this, you know, there was no greater honor than that. And as a writer as well, you know, because for years and years, I would bristle slightly when the only thing I'd done that anybody had heard of was Doctor Who. Now I completely embrace it because it's part of a spectrum of stuff that I've done. It's not the most lucrative thing. It's not the, you know, it's not the most satisfying thing that I've done because, you know, it was quite a rocky development process, as has been recorded in interviews and you know, observations elsewhere, particularly Frank Collins's Black Archive book, where he does a very, very thorough and very fair and balanced investigation of all the kind of controversies around the show. Stuff in there that I was never aware of at the time. And just, I was just walking around with a sort of dazed look.
Yeah.
writer on set.
Was it special at the time, though, despite the fact that it was reality and reality always bumps up hard against dreams? But was it still, oh my God, I'm writing Doctor Who? Because I know I know myself having recently, you know, I'm writing for Big Finish. Mm. And writing for creations that I first probably wrote for when I was five or something.
Yeah.
I'm now getting paid to write for. There is that slight pinch me moment. I mean, where were you as a sort of young man? Oh my God, I'm writing for Doctor Who. Was it a big deal because it was Doctor Who? Or was it just, oh great, I'm writing for TV?
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely mixed and hugely complex. Yes, it was all of that, yes. It was fantastic to be writing for Doctor Who. Then there is a kind of selfish thing saying, well, I deserve this, you know, which is not right, but you kind of feel that. There's a certain amount of ego saying, well, this is, you know, my launch pad to great things. You know, I won't be around here long. I shall be moving on to... And that, again, is wrong. You know, they're all wrong, but they're all right at the same time, because it's that strange mixture of kind of ego, assertiveness, arrogance, childish enthusiasm. You know, they all work together to sustain you and to drive you forward. Yeah. Any one of those is just not enough. You know, as a writer, what you're putting down on the paper, on the page or on the screen or whatever, is as much a sum of your character flaws as it is of your talent or anything else.
I always wonder if, because I haven't seen you at Gallifrey, when fans were coming up saying, you have written my absolute favourite Doctor Who adventure of all time. I wonder if, A, that just must be nice anyway, but also, as a science fiction fan with your own heroes, do you think that makes it easier to sort of go, okay, that's good, you know, see yourself in the sort of grand sweep of science fiction and fandom and all those sort of things?
Yeah, it is nice. You're absolutely right. It's lovely. And I can, because it was so long ago, I can kind of stand outside it now. And I have learned to appreciate the fact that what it means to me is one thing, and what it means to, you know, the person at the other end of the pipe, if you like, you know, I'm putting it in at one end and they're receiving it at the other. And what they're receiving at the other end is a kind of mix of what I've said, what I've thought, what has been done to it along the way, and their own lives and feelings. And if anything, the element of their own lives and feelings is the dominant one in all of that. So yeah. If I hit, you know, and I'm finding now that my biggest, best audience was people who were silent at the time. You know, they weren't the critics. You know, they weren't the people who immediately addressed me. And this is true of every phase of my career, all the way up, because I've got producers in the 30s now who said, oh, I saw Chimera and it scared the bejesus out of me. I wasn't supposed to be able to sort of, you know, but my parents kind of turned a blind eye and let me stay up. And they, in a way, were my core audience at that time. And, you know, not the adults who just kind of watched it once and moved on, but the people who carried it forward into their lives, the way that I carried, you know, my early influences forward.
Chimera is something I only sort of watched recently. For some reason, in that era of it, if you didn't see it on TV, you didn't see it. Did it come out in 91 as well?
Yeah, made it in 91.
I was at university. I did not have a TV. And I was doing many other things, not watching TV. So that probably explains it as well. Early 90s.
We all have that phase in one form or another.
I've had to catch up on lots of stuff in the 90s over the past few decades, like Cracker and things like that. Stuff that I just wasn't watching on TV, which has since become some of my favourite stuff. But Chimera is an interesting one. You know, that would be of special interest to Doctor Who fans and sci-fi fans. I mean, how did that? It started off as a novel, I believe.
It did. It was my first kind of proper novel, in inverted commas, because prior to that, I'd done the three books in as novelizations. You know, so they'd been scripts first, and then I'd turn them into books. And Chimera was an idea that I'd pitched to my agent, who had been my first editor for one of those books, and she'd moved into the agency business and take me on as her first client. And I described Chimera, and she said, I think that could be a bestseller. And so with that encouragement and that enthusiasm, I tackled it. And what I did was I used the technique that I'd developed for the radio plays, in that I wrote the outline, and then I broke the outline into scenes, and then I added the dialogue to the scenes, and only finally did I write the prose. Mm-hmm. A technique that I use even to this day, and it serves me very well.
How would you describe Chimera?
It's the Frankenstein story in the genetic age. It starts with a mystery. The staff of a remote research clinic and fertility facility have all been slaughtered, and there's a clampdown, and we have a researcher who was played by John Lynch in the TV show called Peter Carson. And his ex, who has just broken up with him, is a nurse at this clinic. And he doesn't get a message from her. He doesn't get a reply to his message. So he goes up there to try and patch things up. And of course, finds that everyone's dead and there's no explanation. And when he tries to get an explanation, he's sat on really quickly. And what he uncovers is that there was a creature here that got out of its cage and killed everyone. And the story behind the creature getting out of its cage is that it was the first man-animal hybrid that had been created, and that the purpose of the fertility clinic in this remote location was actually to create this man-animal hybrid. And the fertility clinic was a front which enabled them to collect eggs from volunteer donors without the donors knowing what those eggs were going to be used for. And what they'd done is they'd created a being with a consciousness, with a soul, if you like, with a point of view, which they were treating as a research animal, and had the intention of dissecting it in order to see how to make more. And the animal, you know, the creature who the handler had called Chad, was aware of this. And the animal handler who looked after this creature couldn't bear the thought of what they were going to do to it. So she took the lock off its cage one night and said, you know, you can run or you can stay, or it's your choice. Mm. And of course, the creature's choice was to kill everyone.
Yeah.
The only survivor of the whole thing was the animal handler, who'd opened the cage and then buggered off down to London, away from whatever consequences might ensue, not realizing that this would be the consequence. She thought the creature would just run out and run away and take its chances. But you know, it turned upon its creator.
Yeah, it's a brilliant story. And I can see why it scared people who were young at the time, because, you know, the special effects are pretty good, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And the Chad's a very memorable cult.
It was just the end of the prosthetics era, and it was pre-CGI. I mean, if it was done now, and of course it's been done in various forms many times, it would be a CGI creature. There was something special about having a physical effect. And you can do just about anything in CGI, and sometimes that can be the problem. You know, I picked up, well, it was my birthday a few weeks ago, and my wife asked me what I wanted, and there is an Italian widescreen movie, a crime giallo from the 1960s, which is an action movie with tons of car stunts and car crashes. And it's not the best storytelling in the world, but it is great spectacle, and you know darn well that when you're watching it, you're watching things that happened, as opposed to things that not only didn't happen but were created, but things that probably couldn't happen the way you're seeing.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic new saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And issue 3, Omega El Tralla, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe, or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
Warriors Gate, the novelization that I think you've got Gareth to thank for encouraging you. So tell us a little bit about how Warriors Gate, your original novelization, came to be republished, and is then a wonderful audio four discs with John Culshaw doing the voice.
He's doing all the voices. Yeah, if you can't get Tom himself, then
But how did that come about?
Originally, when I did the novelization, I went back to my first draft scripts. Not quite first draft, but, you know, the scripts that were in the developed form that I was happiest with, before they were kind of rewritten and chopped down for shooting scripts by Chris and by Paul Joyce. And there were extra scenes, there was a different dialogue, there was different development, and there was background. And I wrote the novelization based on that version, and Christine Doniger, who was the editor at W.H. Allen at the time, who was handling the Doctor Who books, she is now the sort of foremost French translator of fiction, won a huge prize for her translation of Les Miserables, I think it was. But back then, she was this junior editor handling the Doctor Who franchise, and my novelization had run a bit long compared to the usual ones. And she'd gone to her editorial board and said, look, we've got this and it's actually quite good. Can I have extra pages for it? You know, can we go to a greater length? And she got approval for that. So everything was looking great. You know, I was going to be doing something that was just a little bit different in the Doctor Who novelization field, something that took the story a little bit further and a little bit deeper and a little bit away from the TV show. But when John Nathan Turner saw the manuscript, because he had to see all the material and okay it before it could go to print, he wouldn't okay it. He said it had gone too far from the TV product and he wanted a complete reflection of the scene-by-scene show, you know, that one saw on the screen, which to my mind was not right. That's not what I look for in a novelization. What I look for is a completely new exercise in the imagination, compared to what it's taken from. I've always felt that, you know, I grew up loving novelizations for the different take on the material that it gave to me. So in very short order, I had to restore the manuscript to a state it had never been in, but to make it conform to the TV scripts. And that involved actual cutting and pasting, because, you know, this was pre-computer. So out came the scissors, out came the glue, out came the Tippex, and I had to remake the manuscript and then send that off to Christine. And the published version was that. And it went down really well, I've got to say. You know, it was quite a well-regarded, well-received novelization of its time.
It's a thin one, though, isn't it? I had it as a child, and I remember thinking, this is quite a thin one.
Yeah. And and I was left with this rather thick envelope of the bits and pieces, you know, that had been shorn from it in order to make it conform. And over the years, every now and again, you know, I'd tell this story and somebody would come up with the idea of, you know, well, let's, you know, why don't you, do it as it was? And I said, well, there's no copy of it in that original form. I do have the bits and pieces, but it's quite a gargantuan task of jigsawry to put that back together again. You know, it's a massive editing task. And it was only when Gareth volunteered to do it that I kind of caved in. I said, okay. But what then happened was that we took it to various outlets and places. Well, we took it to I think it was whoever was publishing Who at the time. I'm not sure if it was the current lot or whether it was the previous lot. But anyway, they turned it down. You know, they weren't interested in doing a revised novelization. And of course, you know, Gareth would have been putting a lot of work in, and, you know, work costs money. Mm-hmm. And that would have been part of the budget. And suddenly we didn't have a budget. So that kind of went by the by. But in the meantime, BBC Audio had heard about it. And I got contacted by them and invited to do it for an audio. But again, there was no budget for editorial. So in the end, having come this far down the road, I took it on, you know, myself, because I'm cheap. And in the course of 1 week, and I have to say, it was a complex job, but it wasn't the gargantuan task that I'd foreseen. And probably the fact that I was doing it was necessary. You know, it would have been a lot to pile onto somebody else's shoulders. But as I went through it, you know, and as I held the old pages up to the light and I could read the obscured type through the Tippex, and I was using the scripts, which I did have copies of, as the guide, and I could slot the missing stuff in. And I think there was very, very little connective material needed to be written, if any. And the whole thing came back together again. And there, I remember I had coloured pages. I'd scanned and printed all the different versions onto different colours of paper so that I could track them. And I assembled a final multicolored manuscript and then ran that through optical character recognition to get a digital file, and that's how we came to get the audiobook. Having done all that, I've tapped the people at BBC Books to see if they'd be interested in publishing a print version. Not a sausage.
Oh dear.
And I can't go and do it myself because I don't have the license.
No. Fortunately, you do the Thowels, and for that, Cutaway will be eternally grateful. And I can't wait to get stuck into carrying on Faustine's adventures myself. And also, I'm getting to, with your permission, as you know, I'm getting to use the beginning of your novelization, and as sort of the opening of one of the future comic books that's coming out for Gods and Monsters. So it's all
an intricate universe we're weaving here.
We are. The potential that's in your Warrior's Gate creation is huge. Me and Gareth already talk about the Gallagherverse.
Well, there is a lot of backstory to both the Gundan and the Tharals, which obviously is great for us because we can mine it, we can expand upon it, and there is stuff there that we can add new invention to, as opposed to having to pretend that it was there all along.
No, it's fantastic, and I look forward to sharing it with the audience. So you've got Warrior's Gate and Terminus, and then as I know, because I was lucky enough to have with Gareth from Cutaway have a guided tour to Los Angeles. So you had the was it a decade being a TV writer in Hollywood?
It feels like it. It was on and off, and there was a period that I relocated there, and prior to that there was a period when I was working for American TV but working from Britain. Then there was a time when I was shuttling back and forth doing pitches, and that ended a couple of years ago, and I've not really done anything over there since. So, yeah, you're probably right about from like 2008, which is when I got the Crusoe gig, 2016-17, when Spielberg bumped me out of the afternoon slot for a show called Risen.
Spielberg.
Yeah. At least he gave me a story. I can tell the story.
To bring it back round to the format, so your final three choices, which is always good to see, and I think is testament to the sort of genius of Russell T. Davis bringing Doctor Who back in such a good way. Almost the sort of opposite of what happened with the TV movie in 96. He worked on bringing Doctor Who back for a modern audience. In such a, his instincts for television are unsurpassed. So the fact that your final three choices are from what people call New Who, which is now, God, 17, 18 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, I've heard it called Welsh Who as well.
Welsh Who. I've never heard that one. But that's brilliant. So one that's popped up quite a lot, so we won't spend too much time talking about it, is Rob Shearman's Dalek. Mm. That's on a lot of people's lists. It probably would be on my list as well, because for me, as I've said on other podcasts, that was the moment when I went, the show is back. Mm. I was the journey that Russell had designed, as Rob Shearman said himself, is, he was just very lucky to get the Dalek episode based on his Big Finish, but also the where it landed in the season was very meticulously designed by Russell. Mm. But what was it like watching that in 2005, wasn't it?
I immediately appreciated the craft of it, the thought that went into it, and to a certain extent the clean simplicity of it, because it goes back to that business I said about the juggler. Here you've got one doctor, one villain, one Dalek, one assistant, or one companion. Mm-hmm. I still call them assistants because that kind of comes from the early days, but companion. And it was a case of ringing the changes, developing, building on the developments, and taking it to a really satisfying conclusion. And also the great thing about Dalek is that it has heart. It's about something. It's not just about, here's a villain, what technical trick can we find to defeat them? Mm-hmm. How can we get out of, every single element in it is driving it forward in some way. It's actually treating the Doctor as a character rather than a cipher, which you could sometimes be in the old days. Just a cipher who spouts aphorisms and amuses us all with and wows us all with his eccentricity. No, here we had an actual kind of complex, flawed human being, mm-hmm. or not human being, given that it's the Doctor, but a human soul, and pathos as well for a creature that has. We've lived with for so long, and which we kind of understood on one level, and now we're being invited to understand, from the enemy's point of view, And, yeah. And yeah, you know, I think everybody was bringing their best game to it. You know, you say Russell positioned it well. Rob did a great script. Joe Ahern, I think, did a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I should add at this point that a couple of years ago, Scott Free optioned Chimera for a reboot.
Oh, wow.
And Joe was going to be directing that. But what happened was that Scott Free's American office pulled out of London. You know, they weren't supporting any British-initiated projects. So Ed Rubin, who was the producer who wanted to do it, you know, there was no role for him that he could see. So he moved on to other things. And I got the rights back. But the Joe Ahern-directed Chimeras, that's the show that never was, which we can all lament. But yeah, no, I think Dalek, that was... superb piece of atmosphere. Lovely, lovely yeah. construction as well. There's that callback at the beginning where your Elon Musk figure, before Elon Musk was a twinkle in the public's eye, saying, you know, take the guy away, wipe his memory and dump him on the street. And then that's exactly what happens to him at the end. That's the stuff that good construction is all about.
Like almost all of that era of Doctor Who, every episode is endlessly watchable.
Mm.
Because of the structure, because each of them, like your one page, would work on that one page. They mostly fit the 45-minute format. They mostly do everything right, and that's why I always say myself. And I've had three children, or one of them is currently moving through it. I've had three children move through Doctor Who, and each of them focuses in on the Russell T. Davies era because I do think that's when everything was tight as a drum. And there's lots to like in everything else, but when it's tight as a drum, everything works.
Yeah.
And they all, because they're of the generation where you don't have who's your doctor, the one who was on TV when I was a kid, is your doctor. This generation, who's your doctor? And they all say Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant.
Yeah.
They were doctors before they were born.
Yeah.
But that's, and now with David Tennant back, they're all absolutely. Actually going to watch Doctor Who again
that's going to be interesting.
Watch it with more enthusiasm. But that's going to be, that's a whole other thing. But but I agree. I just think Dalek is like a perfect slice of Doctor Who. I mean, it must be one of the best. Well, let alone Doctor Who, it's a really good, really good episode of television. It's one that, I mean, that's why it was watched by an audience far beyond us geeks.
Doctor
Who in those days. And I guess in a similar way, your next choice, which is The Empty Child, which we always put Empty Child / The Doctor's Doctor Dancers. You've allowed both episodes.
You see, I'd forgotten it was a two-parter. And
that's
So I'd put time, I was going to rewatch for this. So I'd put time aside and I realised as we got to the end of The Empty Child, oh my God, I have miscalculated here. So,
but I did
review them.
Yeah. No, that's good. I luckily with your choices, I didn't have to because, like I said, I've rewatched them a lot myself, and I have had three children grow up.
Yeah,
They're the episodes, not so much your final one, but the gas mask terror of Child. Are You My Mummy? That is proper playground running around. They still get it now.
I have to say about my final one, The Girl Who Waited, I was misremembering there. The episode I was thinking of was actually The 11th Hour.
Oh, right.
And that's the one I cited. Because when I sat down to watch The Girl Who Waited, I thought, hang on, this isn't right. What I'd actually done...
Well, let's go with The 11th Hour then.
Yeah, well, I'd taken the...
Loads of people pick Girl Who Waited, so that's fine.
Yeah, well...
So The 11th Hour, what is it about The 11th Hour then?
I'll tell you what it was, and it was the little girl, and it's Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Peter Pan appears to Wendy when she's a small child and comes back again when she's a grown woman. And the reason I have thought all these years, oh yeah, that's the episode, The Girl Who Waited, is when he says, you know, I'll be back in 5 minutes. And it always stayed with me when she runs upstairs, packs a little suitcase, takes it in the garden, sits on it and waits for him. And it's a little bit like that scene in Futurama where the dog waits outside the shop for the guy who never comes back and just gets older and older and older. Until finally, and it's just so touching, and it's just, and then you know that whole bit of her again in later life, and of course it introduced Karen Gillan, who I thought, you know, was fantastic in the show, to the extent that she kind of overshadowed so much that was in it. So
the companions do that a bit under Moffat's tenure, which is kind of like he's cast people who are amazing and created really strong characters.
Yeah,
and the Doctor's still the Doctor.
Yeah, but I do think I do think Moffat maybe has a bit of a Peter Pan complex, because if you go back to The Empty Child, you've got the girl and the lost boys.
Yeah,
she takes from house to house, feeding them on on all the table spreads while the occupants are in the Anderson shelter.
Moffat's never afraid of the John Updike thing, which is pick your theme and fill a shelf.
Yeah,
Moffat's very much. Yeah, he has his Peter Pan. He also had his sort of time traveler's wife thing. And up to the point where he's now adapted the time traveler's wife itself. But yeah, so those things repeat throughout his Doctor Who writing. You're right, but back, you know, especially when they were fresh, The Girl Who Waited is amazing as well. But the 11th Hour, it's also, I think that first season is very important in terms of Doctor Who. That's, even though it's the third Doctor we've had of the new version, it's almost a Patrick Troughton moment, because we'd had Eccleston and Tennant, they almost merged together. Because it's Russell T. Davis, but this was, if that had failed, Doctor Who would have been cancelled by now. And that first Moffat season is brilliant. And
also, of course, it was Matt Smith's introduction.
Well,
and
yeah,
I'd been thinking, how on earth is this going to work? You know, he's so young. He doesn't look the part. How can he act the part? And of course, by the end of the episode, I was completely won over, because what he was so good at was acting the ancient soul dropped into a young man's body.
Yeah, no, I think he's phenomenal. He really is. I remember seeing him in Moses Jones, which was like a sort of breakthrough. It's a piece of TV, but it was a sort of breakthrough role for him. He was a sort of detective, but not the main character.
Mm.
And he basically is. And you kind of watch that. When I heard he got cast, I watched that and went, he is the Doctor, because it was like you could sort of imagine him just from that performance.
I'd seen him in nothing before, so this was like my introduction and my revelation.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's the 11th Hour is a fantastic episode. So before we wrap up, just Empty Child, this sort of how was your rewatch of that?
I thought the first episode was much stronger than the second.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we've also got John Barrowman in there as Jack Harkness. And, you know, John has blotted his copybook a bit with his image.
Yeah.
It's weird how you know, life and art, how closely should we regard them, and to what extent should we separate them? And it's difficult. I mean, I always think of Caravaggio, who was kind of a reprehensible bastard in his time, but his time was so many hundreds of years ago that we can look at his art and kind of put him apart from it and just appreciate the art for what it is. When it's somebody who's still out there, still working, and, you know, it was quite recent, it's quite difficult to separate the two. And obviously, you know, Barrowman's not in the category of some of these, you know, sort of out and out molesters. He let his exhibitionism run rampant by the sound of it, and people were uncomfortable with that. But that's, you know, that's it's maybe in the same spectrum, but it's not of the same order. Suppose I'm trying to say, you know, how you approach the show with all of that in mind, I don't know, but it's a problem, because you know you work on stuff these days, and you think, well, you know, I just hope my people who I'm working with now don't blot the copybooks further down the line and obscure the work that I've been doing. You know, when a piece gets cancelled, you know, to use the current parlance, you know, people do complain about being cancelled, when the fact is, you know, they're just not wanted anymore. You know, that happens. But, you know, when a piece gets cancelled in that way, then the work of a lot of honest, hardworking, completely blameless people gets tossed in the trash can as well.
Yeah. I mean, I generally think life is very complicated, and, you know, I could still watch Kevin Spacey, for God's sake. I watched Seven the other night, and I was still able to watch it. In fact, he's playing a horrible serial killer. So,
well, that helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But, But when it comes to you know, there were a few figures people won't watch certain writers. Some fans won't watch certain writers' episodes because of transphobia and things like that. And generally, I just think God, life is too complicated. Start making too many judgments, and we don't really know what went on. But yeah, but we, you know, I don't want to get cancelled myself, so I won't make it a full throated defence of Barrowman. Obviously, people were very uncomfortable with what he did at the time. The character of Mickey is also in a lot of these episodes, but not that one.
Yeah, yeah. Managed to avoid all that.
yeah. But as a piece of writing, because you know, you and me are both writers, so I just think it's especially, like you said, especially the first episode, absolutely wonderful. Everything builds in the right way. You've got an iconic. I mean, Moffat has. I mean, he's a brilliantly talented writer, obviously. And I think people tend to focus on flaws. I mean, I think that's maybe what some people, that's their go-to place is forget all the amazing stuff. He didn't quite do that right. But I mean, Moffat, as well as keeping Doctor Who going, making it even bigger, the Weeping Angels and the Gas Mask Empty Child, those two are like up there with the, you know, with Doctor Who monsters for all time. Yeah. My children, you know, my 7-year-old does the three stages, you know, he does that, then that, then that. And yeah. That's what all three of my kids have been doing, as well as the exterminate. They've all been Weeping Angels, and they've all been Are You My Mummy at various stages.
Yeah. One of my fondest one of my fondest memories of the Gallifrey one convention we were at was the Meeping Angels.
Oh God,
the Weeping Angels with Beaker's head.
Oh God, I shared that on Twitter and it got so many likes. But they're brilliant. What an amazing costume. Yeah, we'll have to put a little when I put this episode out on Twitter, I'll put my picture of the Meeping Angels. It's absolutely brilliant. But I think I've taken up enough of your time here, Stephen. But it's absolutely wonderful to catch up with you.
It's been fun.
I'll be it over Zoom, and we'll have to meet up in the real world at some point. Because being taken around LA by you, the hangover was my fault. The tour was all the good stuff.
I seem to recall you missed the plane the next day as well.
Oh God, yes, yeah. Me and Gareth, but that was because we were in a really good mood. We were in such an amazingly good mood, and we just sat drinking. It's like we'd forgotten how to fly. We'd forgotten about calls and that you couldn't just run up at the last minute like it was a bus. So we got there and we could see it. We could see the plane.
Yeah, and you're not on it.
But yeah, now it's in the rear view. 3 days stuck in LA is now like we had good fun in those extra 3 days. Just had to buy new flights.
Yeah.
It was unfortunate. Unfortunate, but yeah, we'd had an amazingly cracking time at Gallifrey One. It was such a pleasure. What's sort of coming up next for you? As well as obviously, you've got, most importantly, you've got Faustine, Princess of Thirwell coming out shortly.
Yeah.
Or depending when people are listening to it, it might already be out.
I got my old trilogy out, which I was talking about earlier, and I've got a couple of shows. I've got a show of my own, which I've been developing with a German producer, which is looking for a co-producer now. Mm-hmm. And that's a big contemporary thriller, no science fiction aspect to it at all. And I'm serving as executive producer on another writer's show where it's a young writing team, and I'm kind of the old guy and the safe pair of guiding hands, which I never imagined would be a role that I would ever qualify for. But in this world, that seems to be the way I'm regarded now. Yeah, I've got a couple of other things. I've got a comics pitch out there, which is probably due a chase now. So I'll see how that goes.
As in graphic novel, as in...
Yeah, yeah.
Just because, I mean, I guess that's thanks to Gareth taking you on for Cutaway. And
It's enthused me about the medium and made me realise that, yes, I can do it. And but it's not kind of Hooniverse, as it's called. It's completely unrelated. So my agents put that out for me. And I've always got something on the go, always something cooking, always a couple of short stories. Because I used to just do short fiction in between the big projects. And now sometimes I do the big projects between the short fiction.
But anyway, that is all we have time for today. And Steve Gallagher, hope you don't suffer too much being alone with your five choices in the bunker for the rest of your natural. Lonely dog food and these five choices. But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, Steve. And I will see you in the real world very soon.
Been a great pleasure for me. Thank you.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter @cutaway.